Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Pharma Talk Radio, brought to you by the Conference Forum. I am Valerie Bowling, the Director of Programming, and today's show is dedicated to serving patients in clinical trials. Before we get started, I would like to thank our sponsor, Inventive Health Clinical. So this is our second show in the Clinical Air series hosted by Craig Lipset. And Craig is Head of Clinical Innovation R&D at Pfizer. And Craig is also the co-chair of our DPharm Disruptive Innovations in R&D event, which is happening on September 19th and 20th in Boston. And joining Craig today is his fellow co-chair, Dr. Andreas Koster from Janssen Pharmaceuticals. And joining us later in the show is the CEO of Mitris, Anthony Costello. So with that, I will let Craig take over. And hello, Craig.
Thanks a lot, Val, and welcome aboard, everyone. This is episode number two, flight number two for Clinical Air on the Pharma Talk Radio Network. My name is Craig Lipset, and while I lead clinical innovation at Pfizer, the opinions on this show are my own and not necessarily those of my employer. I'm excited to broadcast today from beautiful Cambridge, Mass., an exciting hub for innovation and technology. Our first episode, which is also posted online, has really taken off. It's exceeded our expectations for listeners. If you haven't had a chance to take a listen, I encourage you to go back. That was with Joe Kim from Shire and Hugo Stevenson, a serial entrepreneur, and we covered some topics around data sharing, electronic informed consent, and other thoughts on inspiration. For episode two today, we're going to continue that same format, unscripted, authentic conversations with interesting people doing some amazing things. For this episode, we've titled To Serve Patients. And it occurred to me just before we went live that that some folks online may get the reference and others may not be familiar. To Serve Patients, that was actually meant as a little bit of a play on a title from a 1962 episode of The Twilight Zone, Serve Man, which is a classic episode that we'll talk a little bit about in a few minutes. But my first order of business right now is to introduce our co-host, our co-pilot today, Andreas Koster. As I mentioned last time, Val gave me the opportunity to think of anyone we wanted to invite as hosts and guests for this show, and I'm thrilled to include Andreas from Janssen. He's someone I'm delighted to cross paths with at various conferences and through various collaborations. He's really a force in this field because he gets out there and he shares his work. And with that, Andreas, welcome aboard.
Thank you very much for your kind introduction, Craig. Very happy to be here. First time in my life I'm on radio, so if you hear my voice tremble, then it is with the unusual excitement this new medium brings.
Wonderful, wonderful. Andreas, tell us a bit about your work at Janssen. What do you look over? What do you look after at Janssen?
Yeah, happy to do that, Craig, and maybe first a little bit about my background so that our listeners know where I'm coming from. I have worked the past 20 years in clinical development in both clinical roles and in more operationally oriented roles, and I have always preferred the operational side of things. Knowing that when done right, you can really make a difference in terms of both data quality and speed with which the data are being gathered. But no matter how good you get in operations, there is always the overarching framework we are operating under, which has not changed in the past 20 years. So it was for me a great opportunity to step out of doing the operations for a program, for a compound, in the most efficient way, but really look across Janssen's portfolio of clinical development programs we are running, and to see how can we change the framework in a way that we become more efficient and that we serve our two most important customers, the patients and the investigators, better, meaning with better service, with better responsiveness, and with really taking into account what is important for them in the clinical trial process.
So you really came at this from an insider perspective. You were in the trenches. You were in the operations at Janssen. How does that serve you in your current role? I would imagine there are some folks that might say you need an outsider to disrupt, but do you really, and how does it serve you to have come from deep in the organization?
Yeah, probably I have a little bit of biased view, and my view would be if you don't understand the intricacies of the regulatory guidelines, of the processes, of what people on different levels in the clinical trial organization struggle with, I think then you would have a hard time to come up with a solution that can change the current paradigm. And I think, and that's true probably for everybody who claims to work in an innovative field, that it needs combination of the subject matter expertise together with the ability to maybe step back and despite or with the subject matter expertise to take kind of an outsider's look at things as opposed to being trapped in, okay, this is what we have always done and let's just tweak and go for incremental improvements, but take a broader look and see how do other industries have tackled similar problems. And then with this combination of insider's experience and outsider's look, hopefully come up with the right solutions.
You know, more and more I've come to appreciate that even though my business card reads innovation, my day job is really a lot of change management, that the actual ideas and the list of opportunities in front of us is pretty well appreciated. And I think we all have, you know, a collective sense of what opportunities may be available to us, but the big challenge we often face, at least in my organization, is how do we actually seize those opportunities? How do we actually position our organization to not only test them, but to ultimately embrace them and instantiate them in these complex organizations? I'm curious, is that the same for your work at Janssen? How do you see change management?
Yeah, I think, Greg, it's a very common challenge all our organizations face, and we hear this whether we talk to our colleagues in the cross-pharma cooperations that have sprung up over the past couple of years, whether it's the Clinical Trial Transformation Initiative or Transcelerate or other fora, that we are all indeed facing the same problem. Drug development is very costly. There is an established path. The risk is very high. Drug development in general, and also the risk to deviate, however slightly, from this established path. So, when you talk about change management and the difficulties that come with it, yes, I absolutely agree. And I think for us being on the forefront and being leaders in this field, it is about taking risk. Sometimes personal risk to say, okay, certain new things, when they are being tried, they have risk. We cannot do it without risk, but with our expertise and with our insider knowledge, we can help mitigate the risk and keep it to a minimum while we introduce new processes and new technologies.
So let's talk a bit about some of those new processes and new technologies. What are you working on right now that excites you? What's at the top of your list right now?
At the top of my list, without hesitation, Craig, I would say it's what we call very broadly EMETS or electronic medication. And that's maybe a somewhat arbitrary term because it lumps a number of things together. But what we understand under EMETS is to track the medication from the factory to the investigator site, to the patient, follow what happens every day, whether the patient takes the medication according to schedule or not, and then brings the medication back to the investigator with automated on-the-fly drug accountability and with the ability to remind patients to take their medication according to schedule in the right dose, as opposed to find out after 2 or 3 weeks that the patient was not compliant and not being really able to do anything about it apart to remind them what the proper schedule is. So that's one aspect of what we call EMETS. The other, and I think equally important one, is to provide the patient with better medication, with better information about their medication than we currently do. Currently, we attach a whole booklet to every medication case that has all the information about the drug in different languages. And when we ask patients, do you actually read it? Do you understand it? Then we see that we have fulfilled our obligation to disseminate the information, but it is not always well understood. And I think here, modern technology offers a unique opportunity for us to present the information about the medication, the proper intake, and so on, in a much more intelligible and an easier way. For instance, with a little video that shows how to open a complicated blister package, and with the ability, as I mentioned before, to track the daily medication intake, and even with the ability to change doses in the future on the fly while the study is ongoing, which, of course, is the foundation to run better and more effective adaptive trial designs in the future.
That's great. There's so many hooks there around that intersection of the patient and the medicine that you're covering. And it's actually a really nice segue to the title that we themed for the episode today, To Serve Patients. So, little spoiler alert, I'm going to mention a bit about that Twilight Zone episode, but I will say, it's from 51 years ago, so if you haven't seen it yet, you're gonna hear a little bit about it. The basic storyline to this was that aliens come to Earth, and everybody thinks that they're just wonderful. They're helping to with giving new technology, maybe the iPhone. They're putting an end to war. They're solving hunger issues, and they even give humans rides on their spaceship off to see their home planet. One of the aliens leaves behind a book by accident, and some of the cryptographers are able to translate the book, and they realize the title of the book is To Serve Man. And they say, isn't this wonderful? These aliens are really trying to do all these wonderful things for us. But the big twist at the very end, and here's your spoiler, is when one of the starring humans in the episode is getting on board the spaceship for his big trip, his staff member comes rushing forward because they were able to translate the rest of the book, and it turns out To Serve Man is a cookbook. And, you know, with that in mind, we thought that that would be an interesting title for the episode today, that patient centricity seems to be in vogue right now. After all, if you want to get something funded, who's going to argue with you if you say it's for the patient? It's like saying it's for the children, right? Who's going to argue with that? But, you know, it makes you wonder how much, you know, are these initiatives really ultimately serving the interests, the needs, the priorities of patients? And if not, how do we get even closer and really meet their needs around research participation in our studies? So with that, I was curious, you spoke really nicely about the eMeds initiative, and it sounds like it has some really good connectivity to patients. How much is that a priority for you and your team at Janssen? Do you have other things that are patient-facing? And how do you guys decide what the priorities are, that where you should focus as it relates to serving patients?
Yeah, very, very broad and interesting question, Craig. And I would say a very important aspect of this is not to patronize patients, as we maybe had a tendency to do in the past, and say, okay, we think we know what the patient wants, but rather, and all the new media, of course, are the perfect tool to do this. Rather, asking the patients what they want and what they need, and then try to accommodate this in our clinical trial processes. So typically, for a new technology like eMeds or electronic informed consent, I think Anthony will tell us a little bit more about later. For a new technology like this, we don't start out with the assumption that this is good for the patient and that it will aid intelligibility and that this is what patients want. But we actually start with a pilot where we let the patient experience the new tools hands-on and collect their feedback, and only go ahead with full implementation if the feedback confirms our prediction that it indeed is useful, aids the understanding, and so on and so forth. And if it confirms our prediction, but that there are that there is feedback about things we could do and should do different and better, then we do just that before we broaden and go beyond the pilot phase. So essentially, it's about getting feedback and engaging the patients as partners in this process.
Go figure. Actually, go talk to some patients and. I like that theme of not patronizing, because it's so easy to default and assume that that you're looking down from your big pharma ivory tower rather than engaging them as participants and partners in the process. That's great.
Right.
You know, I wanted to ask you a question or two about some recent news. I'm curious, how do you stay current with this dynamic world in which we operate? Are you a social media user, or how do you stay on top of the world? What do you read first every day?
I think the proper answer for anyone in our field would be yes, I'm a social media junkie, but I have to admit I'm not. So I rely on the one hand on the old-fashioned media like newspapers. On the other hand, there are, of course, in a large pharma company, a number of resources available, people that scour the world for new development and new ideas. And actually, we have a sister organization, if you will, of clinical trial innovation called Janssen Healthcare Innovation that takes a broader look beyond clinical trials and looks at everything that is going on in healthcare, how healthcare is changing, how it will determine the future of the pharmaceutical industry as a whole. And it is an active exchange with members of groups that are very much outward facing to make sure that we get the necessary stimuli from the outside world, which can or maybe cannot be found in just the news outlets.
And how do you then do you then partner with that that other corporate group, or how do you interact from that point forward?
Yeah, it's indeed a very close partnership, and we evaluate then together when we see new information or new trends about, because there's so many exciting and interesting things out there that one would be compelled to pursue too many. So our main challenge is, in close connection and then dialogue with these groups, to identify those that we think are most ripe for implementation, and then come up with an implementation plan that gives equal value to the technological and process component and to the change management component you mentioned earlier.
You know, Andreas, I'm going to ask you about an article, and it's not going to be fair because I didn't send it to you beforehand, but I'm going to tell you about it, and I'll be curious your thoughts. This is actually a paper that was posted online, I think, August 19th in JAMA Internal Medicine. It's titled Public Preferences About Secondary Uses of Electronic Health Information. And the reason I wanted to mention this is I think it fits some of the theme we were just talking about. This was essentially a survey that was done with 3,300 adults in the U.S., and it was asking those adults about their perceptions about secondary use of their health information, about their electronic health records and other health data about them. And the survey talked to them about data uses, such as if the data would be used for marketing versus public health or research, and if the data may be used by different types of users, hospitals, public health departments, pharma companies. And the reason I thought that this was a really interesting publication was some of the takeaways at the end. So in terms of the results from this, the most important factor to patients when it came to how their data would be used from a secondary use perspective, the top priority wasn't who was using it, but how the data would be used. They were more concerned to make sure that their data was used for advancing research than they were worried about the type of user. So while pharma, let's face it, they preferred seeing their data used by university hospitals over pharma, that wasn't their biggest concern. Their biggest concern was seeing that their data was used appropriately, meaning more for research than for marketing. Does that surprise you? What do you think when you hear those types of takeaways?
Yeah, first let me say, Craig, it's indeed not fair because I have not seen this article, but I'm quite passionate about the topic, so thank you for asking this question. I'm surprised to see, and I'm positively surprised to see, that that patients are willing and more open to allow their data for secondary use in the right hands. That's what I inferred from your summary of the article. And I think that is something inevitable if we as a society and as individual patients want to have, every time we go to the hospital, every time we see a doctor, we want to have the best possible evidence-based medicine and decision-making at our disposal. But of course, that can only happen if the evidence has been gathered before. And clinical trials alone, I think this is what is not disputed. Clinical trials alone cannot serve that purpose on its own. It will need secondary research, and electronic health records will play an important role in this. It will take secondary research on very broad patient data that are available to answer all the questions we have, whether it's about the new medication or new procedure, so that we don't, for a prolonged period of time, let's say the first 5 years or so, use new procedures, new drugs, new method without firm evidence. And I think that will change in the future. It has to change and can only change if each and every patient, each and every one of us, is more open towards secondary use of health information for research. And I'm glad that this publication sees that the trend towards more openness is starting.
Look at that. An unfair question generates an extremely fair and thorough response. I appreciate that, Andres. You probably also enjoy the companion editorial that was written by Zach Kahane from up here in Children's Hospital, who, for those that don't know him, he is certainly an evangelist on this very topic. But he looked at that at those conclusions and took away that perhaps we actually have an obligation, almost a moral imperative, to honor patient preferences and see to it that their data are used for research as they wish. That, you know, that today we almost default that patients would be alarmed or frightened if their data were used for research, and we construct barriers to that. But maybe this is the first of hopefully a series of data that will surface that show that actually it's an expectation of patients that their data is being used to advance research.
Mm-hmm.
Great. Well, I think this this sets up very nicely to add another voice to this conversation, and I'm really excited to introduce our guest, Anthony Costello, CEO and founder of Mitris. I first met Anthony when he was just getting Mitris off the ground, but his legacy in this industry goes much earlier than he and I crossed paths, strangely. So welcome to the show, Anthony.
Thanks, Craig. Appreciate the opportunity to be here with you guys.
So, Anthony, tell us a little bit about what work led you to creating Mitris. What's your backstory?
Well, we'll have to decide how far back we want to go, but I think the relevant piece of my backstory starts at Genentech, most likely. I got out of college and got a job in the consulting industry, and I learned just enough about SAS and SQL programming to be dangerous, and I got a job at Genentech in the data management group. And I was there for almost 4 years, ended up managing the data management development group under the oncology center there at Genentech. So all of the phase 1 through 3 oncology data management activities were in my group. And at that point, we were actually working on the phase 3 trials for Herceptin, and also the phase 1 trials for what later became Avastin. So it turned out to be quite a rewarding time to be at Genentech because of the great products that happened to come through the pipeline during the time that I was there. But I had, as a lot of people that are on the entrepreneurial disruptive side of things like me, I think my story includes a lot of frustration with past experiences, work experiences, and finding problems that you just end up having an itch to try to solve. And that's what happened to me there. And Genentech was a fantastic place to work, but we were spending most of our time on the phase 3 Herceptin trials trying to collect the data coming in on 3-part NCR paper and taking months to get shipped around the world from study sites, and then taking many more months to get data entered and to issue queries and get queries resolved. And those of us in the industry who have any kind of background with the data management process know that the sort of bad old days before EDC, data management was a very taxing, slow, cumbersome process, and the result of which was nobody else on the project team really had a sense of how trials were doing midstream. So these days, we've got a lot of newer technology to help us study the drug during the course of the trial, and we can even make adaptive sort of course corrections throughout the trial and try to use those tools as a way to accelerate the process. But before EDC, none of that was really possible. So I ended up leaving Genentech in 1999 to start an EDC company, and the company that I co-founded is called Next Trials, and Next Trials is still actually there today. And I was there for 10 years as a co-founder and the vice president of product development. And we started Next Trials at the same time that Phase Forward and Medidata had just begun their companies as well. So it was very early on in the EDC era. And there, it became over the next decade that there were 8 or 10 significant players in the EDC space. And I think we've now finally gotten to the point where the majority of studies are done using an EDC technology. So I think that innovation has run its course and become prevalent and normal in this industry. And I think a lot of the other things that Andreas and you, and I know Joe Kim talked about last week, many of the newer innovations and newer clinical trial processes that are exciting to us today, I think have really been inspired and enabled by the EDC era and the EHR era.
So that EDC adoption curve, that was not exactly a fast moving curve to have to ascend. What are your thoughts on penetrating big pharma as now a serial entrepreneur in this field? What advice would you give to others that are looking to start up a platform or a new capability here?
Yeah, well, I love the theme of today's show because I think there's two just critical points here that we keep coming back to. And, one is, what are we really trying to do with patient centricity? And there's a lot of space between patient engagement and patient centricity sort of being the cool buzzword, kind of buzz phrase du jour. There's space between that and us actually redesigning the clinical trial process around patients. And I think we're on a continuum there to probably starting more towards the former and hopefully heading more towards the latter. But I think that one of the major advantages to bringing a disruptive innovation into this market today, like Mitris has done, versus bringing a disruptive innovation in 10 or 15 years ago, is that there is a patient centricity movement going on now that wasn't there then. It wasn't even that long ago when nobody even really wanted to refer to patients as patients. They were subjects or they were participants or they were known by their kind of unique identifier number on the trial. And technology was scary. It wasn't prevalent enough in the broader society yet. It wasn't being used as much in other sensitive areas like banking or financial institutions. And there were a lot of questions about internet security and password security and being able to store data in the cloud and what does that mean and who else can access the data? How do you recover data if there's not a backup copy on a piece of paper in the file cabinet when the database crashes? So I think a lot of those things plagued the start of the EDC movement and made it very difficult for the early companies to get traction. The ones that did, you know, those of you who follow technology firms know that Medidata, FaceForward, and others of that era have done very well for themselves as the conversion to that technology became widespread. But, you know, like we've said earlier, it took 10, 15 years for us to get to the point where the bulk of clinical trials are done on EDC. You know, conversely, MITRIS has an application that I think, you know, we're probably going to talk about a little bit on the show that allows patients to consent themselves using technology that's actually quite similar to EDC technology, and we use an iPad application to do it most of the time. But similar to EDC technology, the devices exist at the study sites, just like the laptops did when EDC started, and all of the devices talk to a centralized network that stores all of the patient's consent data, just like the EDC system. Individual computers use a browser to communicate with a central network for actually storing and managing data. So it's not all that dissimilar to the sort of pathway that I think was paved by the EDC movement, making it much easier for follow-on technologies to get quicker traction.
So let's talk a bit about what you have going on with the product from MITRIS. Is the adoption curve for consent, it's going to move faster, obviously, than EDC, but then it's hard to find things that move slower than the adoption curve for EDC. So what are you seeing as being the barriers in this case for adoption, and what do you see as the opportunities to try and change the shape of that curve?
Yeah. Well, this is, I think, at the core of why MITRIS is so engaged and excited by the patient centricity efforts or movement that's going on now. Is that there? We know now for sure that patients learn better using an interactive educational tool like the iPad application than they do just getting a stack of paper called the informed consent document and then trying to read and understand it. So it's hard to dispute that. We've got empirical evidence that we've had validation studies done, and I think the normal person who's not thinking too hard about it will just take that as a given. Patients learn better. It's better for patients to learn the details of the trial before they sign up for it, right? It's hard to contest that. The IRBs and regulatory agencies are very supportive of a technology that standardizes patient education across sites because they're concerned that in a 150-site study, some patients are learning the details of the consent very well and other patients at different sites might not be learning the details so well. So they like a way to standardize the technology. And so something that's good for patients, something that's good for IRBs and regulators, something that's good for sites, the last piece that we spend a lot of our time trying to put together are the sponsors, the pharmaceutical companies themselves. We spend a lot of our time, you know, present company excluded, of course, but we spend a lot of our time, honestly, trying to get the pharma companies to get out of their own way in trying to take on these kinds of innovations. And I think anyone who's tried to innovate in this industry understands that there a lot of the process that goes on within pharma is that at high levels in the organization, there's very often a desire to make sweeping changes, bring on innovations, find better ways to significantly move the needle on drug development costs and timelines. And there's a lot of kind of good opportunities there and people with their hearts and minds in the right place. But as you trickle down through the various levels of a pharma company, you run into a lot of resistance typically around innovation. And by the time you bring in the legal staff and the patient security staff and the privacy group and the data group and the CRAs and the project managers and you know, all the various groups that are concerned and perceive risk with new innovation, you end up stymieing the process in a lot of cases. And that's what we have to try to break through with our customers, is trying to get them to understand that if a technology can help the clinical trial process and help patients, how do we get everybody comfortable with the parts of that technology that are the new innovative security-related components that they need to have comfort with before they're going to be able to adopt it?
And this fits really nicely, Andreas, with what we were just speaking about regarding change management. Andreas, what else can an intelligent and thoughtful entrepreneur like Anthony do to help bring companies along and to help in engaging folks to be willing to embrace some of these new approaches? Is it just being patient and keep going after that message, or what else can be done?
Yeah, I think a patient is a virtue when it comes to really persuading and convincing individuals at different levels about a new process or technology. And I think what is very important is what Anthony just said is the his hands-on experience about how large companies work on different levels, and not to underestimate that there is not just one stakeholder or top-down decision-making that would take care of the problem, but that this is a long, protracted, goaded again and again type of process that takes a long breath and patience, and just not to go in with unrealistic expectation that the face value, the appeal of a new solution, is enough to at the end of the day yield its acceptance and implementation.
Thanks. So Anthony, what else do we need to know about your work right now? What are you disrupting? What do you see as being the change you're trying to make happen?
Well, I appreciate the comments Andreas was just making, and I think it ties in nicely to what you guys talked about before I came on the show. There are a lot of levels within an organization that you need to be able to appeal to with the product line. Mitris has worked on really three major products that we're hoping to continue developing. One is the e-consent system we talked about. One is sort of the broader version of that, which allows patient data to be collected remotely. The entire sort of case report form experience for patients can be collected remotely, and we call those direct-to-patient trials or remote studies. And then we also have done some work with Pfizer and are starting to work with others to help begin what we hope will be an era of patients getting their own data back at the end of a trial, or a patient reporting phase, for them to really be engaged throughout the study by having the expectation that they're going to learn something at the end about how the trial worked and how they did, and even how they did vis-a-vis other patients on the trial. The e-consent technology, the way we look at it, Craig, is that it's the last piece of the data chain to have an innovation. So we think that's the disruption. There's been 10, 15 years, as we talked about, of virtually every other part of the clinical data value chain, from ePRO to EDC to IVR systems, to all kinds of centralized clinical files and remote monitoring technologies, et cetera. It's all been innovated, made electronic, and made much easier to use. And here we still are with informed consent on a pile of paper. So in a lot of ways, the electronic informed consent iPad system just takes that last piece of the data chain and does with it what has already been done in so many other areas.
I agree with you there, and I would say yes and, in that I think a lot of people look at what you and some others are doing with consent and say, well, this is great, you use an iPad, it's going to make a better informed patient, it clearly has to be a better way to deliver information. But I think the next, you know, step to that is that notion that the patient can actually continue to manage their consent and their preferences over time. There's the actual knowledge of what the patient has consented to and the ability for that patient to be reconsented or have new information raised in a consent in the future electronically. And in a world where the clinical trial does not end at last patient, last visit like it used to, data continues to be reused and potentially shared in different collaborations. Biospecimens continue to live in biobanks and may have other uses beyond what was initially consented. That ability to have stickiness with a patient is potentially even of greater value than just, you know, the pretty front end that I think a lot of people are finding appealing right now.
Yep, agree completely. In fact, in some ways, the backbone of patient centricity may be that stickiness. You know, have we really achieved patient centricity if we're not sticky with the patient, engaging with them beyond just having to recruit them for a trial and saying, well, I'm glad that we filled our trial quickly, but can we stick with that patient throughout the trial, give them data at the end, continue to engage them beyond the study so that they really are a partner in the clinical research process, which is a long way away from just being a subject or a number the way we've often thought of clinical research patients in the past.
Now, I am going to use some of your comments for a quick shameless plug that my colleagues from Pfizer, Jennifer Wolf, will be talking next week at the DPHARM meeting at the Disruptive Innovations in Clinical Trials Conference here in Boston on some of the work that that we've kicked off in just getting started sharing data back with patients as their studies end, electronic data, and really trying to think through deliverables that a patient should be getting when their trials end. And Anthony, I know from conversations that we've had, that's just the tip of the iceberg. You're right. There's so many awesome ways that that will continue to evolve, you know, thanks to entrepreneurs like yourself really trying to continue to disrupt the space and to serve patients. Let's look to wrap things up, actually, with that. I think that this has been another great conversation. Our goal was to really move the field forward together, and I think we've continued to do that. Andreas and Anthony, I'd like to just ask you both how folks could stay connected with you. But Andreas, it sounds like that would be postcards and fax machines.
I'm old-fashioned, Craig, but I don't want to make myself obsolete. So, of course, you can see the two of us together next week at DPHARM in Boston and approach us the very old-fashioned way, directly and face-to-face. Otherwise, my email and phone number is all over the place, and I welcome your input and ideas and comments.
Thank you, Andreas. Anthony, are you a social media user? Is there anything you wanted to put out there as we wrap up?
I'll take Andreas an iPad next week in Boston so people can contact him. The best way to reach and connect with MITRIS social media is to just go to our public website at www.mitris.com, and there are links there to interface with our Twitter handle and also with our Facebook.
Fantastic. And with that, I'm going to look forward to seeing folks next week in Boston at the DPHARM meeting, September 19th and 20th at the Fairmont Hotel. Check out the conference forum website for more details. And I'd like to just extend my thanks to our fabulous production team led by Val and to our guests, Andreas Koster and Anthony Costello, and, of course, to our sponsor for this conversation, Inventive. Thanks for flying with us today, and we'll look forward to next time.
Thanks very much for having me.
Thanks, that was fun.